History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories around you that really need to be heard. We do not want them to go untold or unremembered. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that pursuit, we end up learning things that so often we really couldn't learn anywhere else. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. It's not too often that you hear the same veteran's voice on more than one episode, but when it comes to 99-year-old George Coburn of Oceanside, California, it just wouldn't have worked to compress his story into one, especially since he had such an intense experience on the first day of the war for America, escaping the sinking battleship USS Oklahoma at Pearl Harbor, but then went on to serve the rest of the war on the cruiser USS Louisville, involved in almost every significant Pacific engagement and decorated with 13 battle stars. Today we're going to hear some of his memories from the Louisville, and we'll just roll seamlessly into that in a few. But to put it in context, especially for those of you who missed our last program, and you can pull that podcast up anytime at hometownheroesradio.com, of course, I thought we'd begin today by revisiting a few of the most powerful memories he shared about December 7th, 1941, on the Oklahoma, a ship which lost 429 men that day. George considers himself quite fortunate not to have become number 430.
The first torpedo hit, and the deck jumped, and it was a little bit more of a shock than when the main battery went off. But we weren't unaccustomed to explosions because we had gunnery practice fairly often. And anyway, the lights went out, and more torpedoes hit the ship. I've heard all kinds of numbers on how many there were, and I didn't try to count them, so I can't argue with them.
Is that the first time that it was really real to you, though, when you felt the impact of that first torpedo? Is that when you first knew that this was real and this was war?
Yeah, I would guess that was probably the beginning of realization that we got a problem here. Mm-hmm. One of the things that happened was a source of oil got ruptured, and we got sprayed with fuel oil, and the deck got covered with fuel oil. And because of that, and the ship was beginning to list, people couldn't stand up. And it wound up that a pool of oil formed against the low side bulkhead, and men were slipping into that pool and just wallowing around in oil down there. I've thought many times, if they just thought about it, they'd have figured out how to get the heck out of there, but they didn't. As far as I know, they probably perished right there. And
because they drowned in the pool of oil?
Well, because they couldn't get out of the ship because they were stuck in this pool. And
again, this is in the dark as well. The lights are out. Can you see anything?
I could see a little because somebody showed up with a flashlight, and that was a big help. It helped the guys that were up on the ladder and trying to get the hatch open. It helped them a lot because they were using their fists and or anything they could find to try to hammer the dogs from their tight position. And well, they finally got it open, and everybody rushed for the ladder, and the darn thing broke. I don't know just what happened, but either some fitting came loose or the pin that secured the top of the ladder sheared, because had a lot of men on the ladder, and the deck was over maybe 45 degrees by then, and oil on the deck didn't help the ladder stay in position either, so it just twisted. And somebody had the good sense to yell, "Everybody get the hell off the ladder or nobody will get out of here. It'll break." And so they, people complied with that. And then we went up one by one. And I don't know whether everybody got out or not. But we got up to the second deck and then on up to the main deck. And there was probably 10 of us together at that time. And I looked back, the normal exit from the ship would be out onto the quarter deck, and that was about maybe 100 feet away. There was a big group of men back there. It didn't appear to be moving. And besides, there was all kinds of gear and lockers and bunks and everything that was loose or jarred loose by the explosions had slid down against the bulkhead, and we would have had to crawl or make our way over that stuff in order to get back to the weather deck. I saw an open porthole. Shouldn't have been open. We were at general quarters. If it had been closed, I probably wouldn't even thought of trying to get out a porthole. But I decided that's for me. I went, crawled up across whatever was available to get a handhold on, and a few fellows followed me. Some of them went and started going back to the weather deck. And anyway, six of us got out of that porthole. And at the time, the side of the ship was easy to stand on because ship had rolled over far enough to where it wasn't level yet, but it was close to it. I didn't feel any fear or panic, but I think I was in shock.
Was there a moment for you where the magnitude of the whole situation sank in, where you could fathom how much had been destroyed and how devastating it was?
There actually was a moment like that. But it wasn't in proximity to the actual happening. It was decades later. In fact, it was fairly recent. I've thought about that morning many times, but this one time it seemed real again. And I thought, "Dang, there's something missing here." And later I wrote that the thing that was missing might be the emotional devastation that we suffered. I wrote, "We lost our home, probably some good friends, all of our personal belongings, and our magnificent fleet was rapidly being turned into junk." I really felt the impact of that morning more strongly at that time than I did while I was experiencing it.
Well, and you know, I threw out that number 429, and the only ship that lost more that morning was the Arizona, of course. But what about your family back here in San Diego? I'm sure they're hearing it on the radio that Pearl Harbor has been attacked. They know that's where you are. What did they experience?
You know, the Salvation Army, some ladies came by when I was at Westlock, and they gave us postcards and already stamped and pencils. And so I wrote on the postcard and put it in the mail. And I was lucky enough to get home in January. And I walked in the door and they thought I was a ghost. The postcard hadn't arrived, and it didn't arrive for several more weeks.
So your mother had presumed, because of the news reports, that you had died.
That's what they thought, yeah. They thought that I'd gone down with the ship like so many others did.
But then you walked in the door.
Yeah.
So what was the look on your mother's face?
Astonishment, and probably mixed with relief and et cetera, but I don't know. Primarily it was astonishment.
And you naturally had assumed that they'd received the postcard, right?
Yes, I had assumed that. And otherwise I might have tried to make some kind of pre-entry contact. But I just walked in the door like I'd been across the street talking to Charlie.
That must have caught you off guard to see your mother's reaction.
Well, yes, it did. It surprised me. By that time, I'd had enough recent surprises, though, that didn't have any problem with it.
For those of us who weren't alive then, we hear about Pearl Harbor, and we can go to the Arizona Memorial and see so many things and hear stories, but we didn't live through that time. Can you explain what the response or the resolve that attack triggered, what you saw in America or in San Diego, in your family, in the Navy, after that, what it was like?
Well, I did see the buildup in the Navy, and it was quite impressive, really, that we had a lot of new ships come online, and we had plenty of people to man them, so our naval strength went up rapidly, even after the loss of the battleships, which up till then had been the frontline defenders. I might add that most of the battleships were repaired and did get to see frontline activity. The Oklahoma, of course, never did. The Oklahoma was sold for scrap and was being towed to the United States and had sunk at sea. And nobody ever explained how it got lost, but well, better than just sinking in the mud in the bottom of Pearl Harbor.
This is a life-altering moment, and one that I can see and we've heard can still trigger emotions for you, December 7th, 1941. But you had the whole rest of the war, and you weren't bored for the rest of the war. You were pretty busy. Tell me about the cruiser that you ended up on and what your duties were there.
Well, the cruiser was USS Louisville, a heavy cruiser. We were equipped with a main battery of 9 8-inch guns, had a 5-inch anti-aircraft battery, and with 8 guns. And we also, I don't remember whether they had the 40 millimeters when I went aboard, but every time we came to the Navy Yard, we got more weapons installed on the ship. We used to say, they're making this darn ship top heavy. It's going to turn over sometime. And it, of course, for a battleship sailor, a cruiser was a different platform because it rocked around a whole lot more than the battleship did. And it took a little getting used to it. In fact, the first time at sea on the Louisville, they got a distress message and they made a turn in big heavy seas, a turn that put them running in the trough, you might say, between the two waves. And I was at topside and I looked up, at a steep angle and I see green water way up there. And I thought, geez, I just got out of one that rolled over. Looks like I'm going to be submerged again. But the Louisville was a buoyant ship, and it just wasn't really perturbed at all. It went on.
Well, and that wasn't for lack of action, because just in recent months, well, in the last year, we've heard about a couple of cruisers that were sunk that have been found. They found the Indianapolis. They found the Helena. And the Louisville was never sunk, but there were some pretty close calls for you. What were some of those moments where it could have been your number?
The Louisville participated in almost all of the island campaigns in the Pacific. We missed one big battle.
Yeah, you missed the Battle of Midway, the one preserved so well aboard the aircraft carrier named for it, sitting right here in San Diego, one of the most impressive military museums you could ever visit. But your ship, the Louisville, missed Midway, that big turning point where, of course, the U.S. lost a carrier and a destroyer and over 300 men. But the Japanese suffered devastating losses, including four aircraft carriers that the Allies put out of commission.
The reason we missed that was we had been sent to the Aleutian Islands, and the Japanese had taken over Attu and Kiska. Intelligence said that there was a convoy on the way to replenish the Japanese garrisons. We were supposed to intercept it and destroy it. We never found it. Now, whether they got through or not, I have no idea. But the weather in the Aleutian Islands was absolutely atrocious. I mean, you could get up in the morning and have relative calm and a sea that was almost flat, and by nightfall, you might have winds of 100 miles an hour and mountainous seas that you couldn't see one ship from another because the waves were so high. And our masts were about 120 feet high.
Doesn't sound like anywhere any of us listening would like to be, does it? It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with 99-year-old George Coburn. What were his duties aboard the cruiser USS Louisville? And what about his close calls with kamikazes? Check out some photos related to George and his story online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and part two of our interview with 99-year-old George Coburn of Oceanside, California. If you missed the first part, in which he goes into great detail about surviving the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, you can access that podcast at hometownheroesradio.com. George was fortunate to escape his sinking battleship then, to go home and surprise his mother, who thought he was a ghost. She had believed that he was killed on December 7th. And when he returned to sea, it was aboard the cruiser USS Louisville, a ship with a pretty extensive history. As soon we'll be able to read in a book George is working on with retired history professor Linda Dudick. And your battle station on the Louisville was the gun director?
Yes. I wasn't an aircraft director originally, and they moved me down to main battery director. And I worked there for a long time. I'm probably responsible for killing more Japanese than most guys that were in the service, because we went in intent on destroying their facilities and eliminating as many of the Japanese as we could. Well, we had different classes of ammunition. We used armor-piercing to destroy concrete emplacements. We used fragmentation bombs to destroy people. And a salvo from our ship was like 9 300-pound bombs landing in a compact area, and to the people on the beach, must have been devastating. I remember one time at Saipan, that's in the Marianas, a little north of Guam, I had direct communication with a spotter on the beach, and he told me, says, bring your salvos down 300 yards. I said, if I bring my salvos down 300 yards, I'm going to be shooting my own people. And he says, no, he says, they've fallen back. You'll be okay. He says, the Japanese, they're tying their bayonets onto sticks, and they're creeping up through the brush and stabbing our guys. So anyway, it's the only time I ever challenged a spotter. I brought the salvos down, and he says, you got them or you need them.
Well, and that's the ugly reality of war, is that it is costing lives. But a move like that, to trust that communication and fire in that position, you're claiming enemy lives, but you're saving American lives, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yes. And I can't say that I regretted what I did. But I think I did a damn good job. You know, when I got commissioned, usually orders for transfer followed or came right simultaneously with the commission. Mm-hmm. Didn't happen with me. I stayed on the Louisville. And I always wondered, was it because they couldn't find anybody that would have me? I stayed on the Louisville, and I wasn't unhappy with that, but it did lead to one incident that the gunnery officer, same guy that I talked to earlier about my commission, says, Coburn, I hear you're fraternizing with enlisted men. He says, you're an officer now. You gotta watch that. And I says, Commander, those people were my friends. They're still my friends, but don't worry about it impairing the output of work. We'll get the job done. He let it pass and never heard anything more about it. But,
well, you described for us the impact that one of your salvos could have on the land. I mean, there are also times where you're firing at enemy ships, and the last battle line we've ever had in war you were part of in Leyte Gulf.
Yes. Our surface engagements were really limited, but we did have that big battle of Surigao Strait, which was, I don't know, I've read that there were more military equipment present and with ships and torpedo boats, destroyers. They awful job on those torpedo boats. They had to run in and launch their torpedoes, and they tried to use smoke clouds and stuff to obscure them, but smoke doesn't impair a radar. But they suffered a lot of casualties.
Well, and your ship had casualties too. And there was one time where you were one of them. You have a Purple Heart.
Yes, that's true. Was Kamikaze, a newly developed weapon. We got our first acquaintance with it while we were down in Leyte Gulf, and that's in the Philippines. And we had a near miss. I don't know what distracted them, but the pilot raised his point of aim, and he went over the top of us and crashed nearby in the sea.
And is that something you could see from where you were?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you're watching him come at you.
Yeah. Then on two consecutive days in Lindayan Gulf, which is north of Manila in the Philippines, they were planning a landing and we were doing shore bombardment. We got hit, the kamikaze hit the faceplate of turret 2, which was heavily armored, but the shock of the explosion separated the top of the turret from the faceplate, and we lost a lot of men in that turret. We also lost some people on the bridge, because fireball rolled up across the bridge and people got burned badly. And the only fire controlman that got lost in action after Pearl Harbor happened there, he was a young fella and unrated, but he was in the anti-aircraft director. And a blade from the propeller of the kamikaze broke off and flew up and sliced through the weather shield around the director, hit this kid in the back and broke his back, and he died as a result.
Did you know him?
Yeah, sure.
What was his name?
I don't name victims.
Okay. Sure. Was that kamikaze attack when you were hit by shrapnel?
I was in the director, but this kid was on the other side of the equipment from me. The one that was really important to me was off Okinawa. And I was in the wardroom, and the call went out to set conditions such and such, which was for anti-aircraft work. And so I started out from my battle station, which under that anti-aircraft protocol, I was back to the anti-aircraft director. I saw this guy coming in. He was about 5,000 yards out, maybe. And I watched him for an instant. They were hitting him, and pieces of his fuselage were getting knocked off and splashing in the water. And I thought, he's not going to make it. But he did. And I had turned and started up the ladder to go up to the director when he hit. And we had a catapult with a scouting observation plane on it. He hit the plane, and the wreckage of that plane and his plane hit the forward stack of the ship and folded it over. And then luckily all that junk went on over the side and lit in the sea. So we didn't have a fire aboard. But he had a bomb, and the bomb went off, and I retained a few pieces of it for a while. But I was lucky. I don't know exactly where I was, because even to this day I have absolutely no memory of the explosion or what happened in the next few minutes. I think I know approximately where I was, and there were holes I could put my fist through in the steel bulkhead, and if I was there, I was darn lucky. Because I had a little bit of shrapnel in each foot, and I had a piece on the cheek of my butt, and I had another piece in the back of my scalp. But none of them was bigger than a BB. Just tiny little fragments. So once again, it was Lucky George. Mm-hmm.
So where did your memory pick back up there? Were you knocked unconscious, do you think? Or you think that memory has just disappeared?
I was still walking around. But then when I came back to consciousness, I was lying on a bench that ran alongside of the wardroom. And I don't have no memory at all of how I got there or when. They put me in my bunk and I hurt everywhere. there wasn't a square inch of me that didn't hurt. And this was a lesson on drugs to me. They gave me a shot of morphine. And about a minute later, all that pain was gone. And I've thought about that a lot of times. I think, geez, there's all kinds of pain in this world. And I can see how somebody could get addicted to that stuff.
Well, and here in 2019, you're talking about Lucky George again. What about then? When you're getting treated there and recovering from where you've been hit all over your body, do you feel thankful that you survived? Do you realize that could have been it?
Oh, I realized it could have been it, yes. I don't know. I just accepted, like, I knew a guy who, one of his favorite expressions is, what is. And that's the way I felt about it. Mm-hmm. What is. I mean, it happens, and it's not within your control. And so you go with the flow.
And he's still going with the flow at age 99. But we're not done yet with George Coburn. A little added perspective as he looks back on all of it. And I think you're going to get a kick out of how he met his late wife, Jenny, during World War II. Don't forget to find photos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, coming down the home stretch with 99-year-old George Coburn of Oceanside, California. Born in Minnesota, he moved to the San Diego area as a young boy and has really seen it grow and develop. He also witnessed so many key moments of World War II, from the attack on Pearl Harbor, which he survived by escaping from the sinking battleship USS Oklahoma, to the largest naval battle in history in October 1944, the Battle of Leyte Gulf, to multiple encounters with kamikazes, including the one that left him peppered with shrapnel off of Okinawa. Well, and we think of Okinawa as the last major battle of the war in the Pacific. But yeah, the reality is there was still danger after that. I mean, the Indianapolis was sunk in July, months later. So what was it like from Okinawa till the war ended in August?
Well, after Okinawa, the Louisville went to Pearl Harbor to the Navy Yard. And we got a new stack. And while we were there, the first A-bomb was dropped, and then the second. And we felt pretty sure that was going to end the war. And I didn't know anything about A-bombs, and hardly anybody on the ship did. I suppose probably some of the higher-ranking officers knew what it was. But anyway, we felt thankful that the war was probably over, and it was for us. We went to what they called magic carpet duty. And I don't remember how many trips we made from Guam to San Francisco, but we did it repeatedly, and we hauled an awful lot of passengers from the war zones out there back to the States. And then the Louisville went through the canal and to Philadelphia Navy Yard, where she was put out of commission. And when they announced the opportunities to leave the service, I had a new wife and a new baby. And I decided enough is enough. I'm out. So I left. And but like I say, a month later, I went back to work for the Navy.
I was trying to figure that out, because here from the time you enter in 1938 to the end of the war in 45, I mean, these are some what typically are the best years of people's lives that you've given to our country, and you've almost been killed a couple times. You only stayed away for a month, and you went right back to work as a civilian on a Navy base? What was that all about?
I had to make a living.
Well, you mentioned your wife, and that was the first thing I noticed when I walked in, was this beautiful portrait of your wife from when she worked at a photo studio. I mean, that looks like it's in the late 40s or 50s, maybe. How did you two meet?
That's another story.
And I see a big smile on your face.
It was Thanksgiving Day, and another young officer named Bob and I had taken a room together in a hotel in Vallejo. And sometime in the early afternoon, the phone rang and I answered it, and it was the front desk, and they said, "We have two young ladies down here that are looking for two officers to escort them to dinner at the home of the brother of one of these ladies. They'll have a nice Thanksgiving dinner for you." And so I said, "Send them up." Mm-hmm. Well, Jenny, that's Jenny, and Beth, her friend, came up, and Beth and I paired off, and Jenny paired off with Bob. Somehow, during the course of the evening, that got changed. I don't know how the hell it happened. I really don't. But anyway, it did, and we had a nice dinner, and Jenny told me later that one of the things that attracted her to me was the way I treated the daughter of her friend's brother. I don't remember much about that, but I remember I was sitting on the floor, and this little girl about 3 or 4 years old was bringing me stuff and said, "Look at this." You know? And I played along with her, and we had a good time. And it impressed Jenny very favorably, apparently. And anyway, our romance was mainly carried on through letters, and we wrote enormous numbers of them. I was gone for 14 months after that, and I might add, that was 14 months and almost never got off the ship. Oh, long, dreary struggle. I don't remember exactly what part of the Pacific I was in during that time. I used to say our operating area is from the west coast of the United States to the east coast of China and from the Bering Sea to the Antarctica.
And that's not much of a stretch.
That just about covers it, yeah.
Well, I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you. I know you received the Purple Heart. Are there other decorations that you take pride in?
Actually, Linda is working with our congressman to try to get the other medals that I earned supplied to me. The Purple Heart, that was well documented, and I have the award, and I even have a picture of the skipper pinning the heart on me. So,
Well, and I guess I have to ask you as well, since you were a part of that day. And everyone heard the president on the radio the next day calling it a date which will live in infamy. That might be the speech that's been heard more than any other speech in history. So Pearl Harbor has this mystique around it. I'm sure it's something that's on your consciousness and has been for a long time. When you've been back to Pearl Harbor, what are the things that come to mind for you? What do you reflect on?
When I go back to Pearl Harbor, I've only been there once, and that probably would be the last time that I was there. But Jenny and I went to Hawaii, and we had to go out to Pearl Harbor, of course. And I don't know, I wasn't impressed really deeply one way or another. I think that time decades later, when I was thinking about it, and it came back so darn real, that's most prominent time, even more prominent than the actual experience of Pearl Harbor. Can't explain it.
Why do you think we should remember Pearl Harbor? Why does it still matter today?
Well, it matters because the thing we need to remember is that even though the world looks pretty peaceful, that you always have to be on your guard. And you don't want to let your ability to fight be severely diminished. It's been kind of an up and down thing in recent years, and I think that our present president has done some strengthening, and hopefully it will continue. But anyway, the basic idea is you go back to the Boy Scout motto, be prepared.
I know I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a really unique story that you have. Is there something, as you look back on all of this, that you would say you're most proud of or you're most thankful for?
I think the Battle of Surigao Strait, and I got worried about the enemy getting too close. And I was on the rangekeeper, and of course I had the distance to the enemy all the time. So I started calling out the distance. We got down to 13,800 yards, and I thought, that's too damn close. Yeah, but we did finally, at that point, we got the word to commence firing. And we'd been ready for a long time, and we got them dead to right. I kind of feel for those poor guys that were coming toward us. But I had a radar repeater right next to me, and I watched our first salvo go out, arc out, and drop right into my target. And I think they couldn't have been totally surprised, because they had torpedo boats attacks and a couple of destroyers attacked. So they knew that we were well aware of their approach, and they had to know that we weren't going to just sit there and let them come. Anyway, we made a real dent in the strength of the Japanese Navy at that one battle. I don't know how many ships were sunk, but a lot of them.
Well, and you've been working for a while now on your memoirs in written form, an account of all of these things. You and Linda Dudick have been working on this. I'm sure a lot of people are going to read that. What do you hope they get out of it when they read your story? Is there a message you want them to receive, or something you hope they draw from it?
Well, one of the things that I would like them to remember, and that's always be prepared, and don't cry over the wealth that goes into keeping the military up, because it's necessary if you're going to survive in this world.
Well, and you've survived for nearly 100 years. You got any big plans for your 100th birthday in October?
I look at it like I look at everything else. Whatever comes, I'll handle it when I get there.
Well, I just have one more question, and if there's anything we left out that you want to get in there, feel free. I'm thinking about everything you've shared, and you made it clear you've never been a religious guy, and you feel lucky But have you looked at the totality of all those chance circumstances of how the porthole appeared and you squeezed yourself out of that on December 7th, how you survived the rest of that day, the kamikaze and the bomb and not even knowing how you survived or what happened to you for a few minutes, and then having a wife almost dropped in your lap when they say there's two ladies here and it's Thanksgiving Day? Have you ever wondered if there's somebody up there manipulating that or pulling those strings for you?
Never wondered, no. You know, when I was a child, I was sent to Sunday school, and we had from Sunday school, they moved us over to a church. I still remember that we had a preacher who was one of those very loud preachers. I mean, he turned me off. I'd listen to him, and I'd think, how do people believe this stuff? If he'd been more convincing instead of so darn loud, it might have changed my whole life. I don't know.
No, you never know. And for those of us who carry a different view on faith and see the value of sharing what we believe with others, maybe that story will give us something to think about. Before we wrap up, Mr. Coburn, is there anything else that you'd like to say about that branch of service you gave some of your best years to and continued to work for as a civilian for so many decades afterwards?
I still feel a kinship with the United States Navy, even though I've been separated from it totally for a long while now. But it's an important part of my life, and I'll always feel that kind of a feeling of belonging. But I can't go back there again. I'm too darn old.
I bet you could still fit in your uniform, though.
I probably could, yeah. No, I couldn't. My waist, when I left the Navy, was 32, and now I'm buying pants that have a 36-inch waist. I wouldn't fit in a 32 anymore.
The hat would still fit.
Yeah, I haven't got big-headed.
And we trust that all of this airtime is not going to change that. George Coburn, 99 years old. Come October, he'll hit the century mark, and hopefully we can all celebrate with him by reading that book about his life and life in the Navy that's almost complete. I'll be sure to alert you when it is, but we're out of time for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.